Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm co-hosting today with Alex. It's Beth here. Always look forward to doing some recordings and finding out some really interesting stuff. And we have got something really interesting for you today. Alex, who have we got with us today?
We have been neglectful so far on Boaty Week. We've had no World War II. I know that Giles at least is out there going, "Where's the World War II?" So today we have World War II, but we have not necessarily a well-known part of World War II because we have Phil Weir with us, the amazing Dr. Phil Weir, who knows all things about all boats and ships. And he's going to talk to us about something different. You didn't want to go down because you obviously have written The Little Ships of Dunkirk and you could blabber on about Dunkirk for days, but you've decided to do something niche, haven't you, today, Phil? How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah. What I've decided to go for is the very little known carrier airstrike by the Home Fleet almost exactly 80 years ago. The anniversary is on the 30th of July of, Royal Navy's carrier airstrike on Finland. Now, not many people know about this.
Beth's just shaking her head like, "What's Finland?" Finland, World War II boats. We're very far out of our wheelhouse today, aren't we, Beth? So should we find out first what's going on in general? Because as far as I know, as a pretty novice on World War II, we're not at war with Finland, are we?
No. And this is, of course, the whole fun bit. Now, a lot of this all basically hinges on, of course, Operation Barbarossa, the German invasion of the Soviet Union that they kick off on 22nd of June 1941. Now, obviously, most people know about the German invasion across what was now divided Poland between after Poland and the Soviet, after Germany and the Soviet Union invaded Poland, they just sort of crunch across their newly agreed border on the 22nd. But there are other operations mixed in there as well. Now, key area to go for is the north. And of course, Germany has invaded Norway April 1940, and the Allies have evacuated in June of that year. So, the Germans have got a force in Norway, and you've also got it's wonderfully complex. You've also got the small fact that, of course, you've got Finland in there, which has fought a war against the Soviet Union, the Winter War of 1939 through to early 1940, where Finland's lost a certain amount of land. They're also now basically sort of trapped between Germany and the Soviet Union, which is this is an uncomfortable place to be. This is not where anybody wants to be.
No fun.
I mean, it's interesting. Of course, during the Winter War, Britain and France particularly had sort of been prevaricating over whether to declare war on the side of Finland and declare war on the Soviet Union. I mean, after all, USSR's invaded Poland and all this sort of thing as well. And this is a live issue. In the end, they decide not to. And of course, the sort of perceived lack of action brings down the French government about a month or two before, of course, Chamberlain falls. So
that's
when
Grandad arrives, isn't it?
Indeed. So there's all of this in the mix, and sort of stuck there between Germany and a hostile Soviet Union without any ability to rely on the Allies. France has now fallen and so forth. Finland kind of ends up falling towards Germany somewhat. And there is, I mean, basically, the bottom line is Operation Barbarossa in the north is launched, and there is a certain amount of Finnish cooperation in there. Certainly, the Soviets accuse the Finns of allowing German bombers to stage through Finnish airfields on their way into to bomb the Soviet Union, and literally on the 22nd, and the Soviets basically respond on the 22nd itself. I mean, it's quite remarkable. I think you almost get a faster response to Finnish participation in Operation Barbarossa than you do by the Soviets than you do Soviet response to the actual German invasion. And they launch a brief bombing raid actually on the evening of the 22nd in retaliation. Slightly larger one on the 25th, which effectively allows the Finns to declare a defensive war, largely sort of in concert with Germany, and start what's known as the continuation war, which they sort of launch into north. Well, actually, it's predominantly into Karelia and the territories that had been lost to the Soviet Union in the Winter War. And they launched that in early July 1941. Sorry. So, on top of this, you've got, as I say, German forces in Norway, then moving in towards into the north of Russia. So, what's Britain's response to all of this? Well, as I say, it's all been relatively complicated up to now. Britain and France had almost declared war on behalf of Finland when the Soviet Union had invaded them first time round. But now, of course, with the German invasion of Russia, to borrow Grandad's line, I should at least give favourable reference to the devil in the House of Commons.
Did you practice that? That's very good.
I do. I especially for these, particularly for you, Alex. Exactly. basically, Britain is now allied with the Soviet Union, and they are starting to develop a military relationship, but Finland has now sort of invaded the Soviet Union. So, all very complicated, and Britain is basically being pressured to do something about the invasion in the north.
So, essentially, Britain is now by default, by being allied with the USSR, is by default at war with Finland? Sort of.
Not really. I mean, war is never actually declared, but the relations are not,
there's
not
no
terribly good at this
on.
Point because of obvious reasons.
Phil, it's obviously quite clear that, as you've just mentioned, there's Britain finds itself sort of quasi at war or not within not good relations with Finland, at least anyway. So why do we find ourselves in an area that we're not familiar with, as certainly I'm not familiar with, and places that I've never heard of them before? Is it Petsamo and Murmansk? You said, where even are these places? Why are they important?
Right. The key to all of this is Murmansk. It's the port in northern Russia, very close to, at this point, the Finnish border. It's a quite remarkable place. And just to bring it back to your specialisation, Beth, it's a city and a port that was founded in the First World War.
Yeah.
And the purpose of it, it was founded with the help of the British. The purpose of it was quite simply to get an ice-free port through which Britain could supply its Russian ally. And they they start sort of constructing the port in about 1915 through to 1917. And you actually start getting Arctic convoys going up during the First World War to try to keep the Russian Empire actually in the war.
I'm just laughing so hard because anytime someone mentions a convoy in the Baltic, I just think of Uncle Albert going, "It was so cold, the flame on my lighter froze."
During the war.
Yeah. It's always on about the Russian convoys, but that's obviously World War II, what we're talking about, not World War I.
Well, yeah, so you've actually got convoys in both, so actually going the same way. So this is the reason that Murmansk has been founded. And obviously, with Britain now allied to the Soviet Union, anybody with half a brain knows that this is basically what's going to happen again. The British are going to start running supply routes through to Murmansk. Now, just up the coast from Murmansk, of course, as is the Finnish border and the mining town of Petsamo, which has a port there. There's lots of nickel mines as well, which were rather important for the Germans and for the German war machine. And slightly further than that is the Norwegian port town of Kirkenes. Dreadful pronunciation. I apologize already to any Norwegians. So it's basically these three ports, right at the top of Europe. You can sort of imagine the top of Norway. This is where we're talking about, the deeply frozen high north. The Germans basically send their a chunk of their occupying force in Norway under General Dietl, their specialized mountain troops, basically, through into the Soviet Union to try to capture Murmansk to stop British resupply convoys. But the trouble is that the roads to basically between Kirkenes and Murmansk is sort of pretty much only one road, and it's pretty ropey, to be honest. So what
it's where
they
your
have
boats
to
come
do...
in.
Yay! That's that is the one. That's absolutely right. What they have to do is run resupply by sea and start shifting General Dietl's gear through the ports across at Kirkenes and Petsamo, and thereafter on the roads into the Soviet Union. And also, of course, as I say, there's lots of nickel mining going on there that the Germans are very interested in. So this is really where the key issue, the Russians want to stop German resupply getting through to their troops that are invading and heading from Murmansk.
So,
and of course, it's in British interest to do so.
Just to lay this out, we've got Finns running into the Soviet territory.
And Germans also going into Soviet territory, just slightly different area.
Yeah, so everyone's going the same way.
Yeah.
And we want to stop. Britain wants to stop both, doesn't it?
Yeah, Britain wants to stop the supply line to those troops that are heading into Soviet territory, and also inevitably protect Murmansk, because that's the key supply line through which Britain is going to try to help and supply the Soviet army. So that is the bottom line of the situation.
So this sounds horrific just for the weather alone. Who draws the short straw in terms of, so obviously you're saying there's no road, so the Britain's going to send in boats. Who draws the short straw? Who gets sent? How? Why?
Well, it's the Royal Navy's home fleet, sat up in Scapa Flow, the guys who've fairly recently sunk the Bismarck, spent the previous year operating off Norway and so forth, under their commander-in-chief, Admiral Sir Jack Tovey, who's a marvellous character, extremely forthright and absolutely no qualms whatsoever about telling his bosses what he thinks of them.
In the best tradition of the Royal Navy, being a pain in someone's ass, right?
Definitely. I mean, he's fascinating. He almost actually doesn't get the job in the first place, owing to the fact that he has a slightly stormy interview with Grandad, where Churchill starts going off on one about how poor Britain's naval preparations were before the war and how it was all the fault of the Admiralty. And
guessing that it was far better in World War One when I was in charge, Line.
Yeah, and
I had my shit together. That just sounds like the kind of egotistical perception I can imagine.
Yeah, and strangely enough, this didn't go down terribly well with Admiral Tovey, who responded in no uncertain terms. And I think there was a sort of brief pause where he sort of ended up stepping out of the room, and the first Sea Lord sort of steps out and says, "You know, don't worry, you've still got the job."
It's almost the best showdown I can remember from World War One is naval again, where Fisher's kicking off, and I think Kitchener loses his shit completely and just walks over to the window and just stands there looking out the window, and the rest of the cabinet's like, "Oh God, he's really pissed off now. What are we gonna do?" And I can't remember who it is who goes over to go, "Is everything okay?" to try and get him to come back and risks getting their head ripped off. But yeah, it strikes me as being one of those kind of interviews.
Yeah, it was approximately that. And I mean, he was in line to become first Sea Lord after Dudley Pound dies in 1943, but doesn't get it, partly because the guy who does get it, Admiral Cunningham, is sort of more famous, better known, more victories and all this sort of thing, and is also slightly more senior, but also because Churchill basically doesn't want to put up with getting told that, you know, his plan's nuts in no uncertain terms, even more frequently than Tovey was doing already. Although it's got to be said, he basically got the same from Cunningham anyway. So, you know, hey ho, lose some, lose some, I think is the, yeah. The one for Churchill. But yeah, he's a fascinating character, about which I think more needs to be known. Mm-hmm. And he looks at this and he's not desperately happy from the off. He thinks it's nuts, basically.
Understandable.
it's taking an aircraft carrier group up into the midnight sun, so no dark to cover the airstrike at all. Really, the Fleet Air Arms aircraft at this point in 1941 are not really capable of dealing with the best of the Luftwaffe's land-based aircraft, which is basically what they're going to be facing when they turn up there. And he thinks this is a potentially a bad idea. And oh yeah, you know, we're not actually at war with Finland, by the way, and we're just about to technically violate a neutral country. So he's not
good first in this, though, isn't there? It is going to be innovative. It's terrifying and slightly morally skewed. But you've mentioned in your notes, because I'm not going to pretend that Beth and I are experts and that we've read up on this, because we're like, just teach us, Phil, let us soak up the knowledge. So you put first use of refueling at sea, and a rare use of a particular fighter in a bombing role. So it is out there, isn't it? They're going to have to do some pretty imaginative stuff to get this done.
Yeah, to a large degree. I mean, it's... I've sort of depicted it as a bit of a losing prospect and all the rest of it. And there are aspects of that, but it's also, as you say, it's quite innovative. And this is what they do. What Tovey does is he puts together an aircraft carrier strike force, arguably the most powerful the Royal Navy can put together at this point. Two aircraft carriers, HMS Victorious and HMS Furious, the old First World War converted battle cruiser. Victorious, absolutely brand new, of course, and escorted by a couple of cruisers under the command of Rear Admiral Frederick Wake Walker, who who you may possibly remember from the Dunkirk bit. He was the guy in charge at sea. He's also obviously done the shadowing of the Bismarck as well. So he's something of a rising star at this point.
Is Furious that one from World War One that basically the first aircraft carrier where it looks like a giant garden shed plonked on a battleship?
That's the one, yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. The
listeners, Google it. It's hilarious. You're like, really? Really?
she goes through a few changes, and she looks rather different by the time you get to 1941, but it looks a bit more like what you would anticipate an aircraft carrier to look like. But yeah, the First World War version, I mean, she starts out with the flying off deck at the front and an 18-inch gun at the back, which the 18-inch gun over the stern is then replaced by a big, as you say, sort of shed piece of a hangar and flight deck, but still with a battle cruiser bridge work in the right in the center. It's quite fascinating to see the evolution. But yes, it's HMS Furious is the oldest carrier the Navy's got, and quite a remarkable record. So, but yeah, Tovey puts together this force, gives it to Wake Walker, who's flying his flag aboard the cruiser HMS Devonshire. They put pretty much the best aircraft that they can find on it, and I mean, it's four strike squadrons of three of the still relatively new Fairey Albacore. Replacement for the Swordfish. It's still a biplane, but surprisingly, in some respects, a lot better. It's got vastly better range. It's got a enclosed cockpit, heaven forfend, to stop people freezing to death and this sort of thing. And it's noticeably quite a lot bigger than the Swordfish as well. And you've also got 812 Squadron, which is the sort of last remaining standout with Swordfish. They're an interesting squadron, and they've fought their way through Dunkirk and various other bits. I mean, there's another Dunkirk connection, and one of their senior pilots is a sort of naval legend by the name of Roy Baker Faulkner, a sort of tall, good-looking Canadian guy who, you know, flies. I mean, in the end, I think he's almost a sort of fleet air arm Guy Gibson. He flies something like 100 odd missions and leads the spectacular bombing of the Tirpitz in 1944. Mm-hmm. Sadly, losing his life shortly thereafter on a again sadly nearly pointless flight. Unlike Gibson, though, he's actually a decent guy. Nice bloke. But yeah, and he's also a sort of taller rugby playing guy as well, but he's a fascinating character, which, you know, at some point we really ought to do a podcast on something like that.
His face just lit up at the rugby player bit. So yeah, Beth will be hosting that one with you as well.
Yes.
Beth also, I should tell you, Phil, that I don't know how much of these you listen to, but we got given a copy yesterday of a book called The History of Sweets, so she's had a really good week with potential podcasts.
This has been your week, hasn't it, Beth?
It really has. It's all things considered. Well, it's gone quite well for me this week for History Hack.
Excellent. So, yeah, you've got, say, probably the most modern set of aircraft they can get with just the one holdout squadron of Swordfish. You've also got the Fairy Fulmer two-seat fighter, which is they sort of started re-equipping with around the time of the Battle of Britain. And it's a useful piece of kit with good range, 8 guns and you know, useful maneuverability, but was desperately so, not least because it had the same sort of Merlin engine as the Battle of Britain Spitfires and Hurricanes, and also had a second seat for an observer, and that was a little bit of a problem in performance terms if you were finding yourself up against a Messerschmitt 109. But you also, as I mentioned, the at-sea refueling. Now, this was something that really had been started practicing. I know the Royal Navy had actually tried to do some refueling at sea before the First World War with trying to transfer coal, but I mean that was just a horrible mess and extremely slow. I think they actually ended up transferring less coal than they were burning at the time. But I mean, this was something the Royal Navy had been interested in really for a lot of years. And they had figured out ways of doing it, usually with using the big battleships and so forth to refuel destroyers, but hadn't really done it from a tanker to a major warship in the way that we sort of think about refueling at sea being done now. This was something the Americans had really started with back in the First World War in 1917. And one of the first examples they did was actually when they came across to Ireland. That was one of their first sort of operational refueling at sea jobs. The British hadn't really done it that much, not least because Britain's got bases all over the world and you just pull into a port for the most part, particularly during peacetime, and refuel somewhere. But for this one, in order to get the range on the carriers and the rest of the force, really for the first time they take with them this refueling group of Royal Fleet Auxiliary tankers, with the intention of refueling at sea on their way up to get them there. So, and this it is, as you say, really quite innovative in that sense. And as you mentioned, it's also one of the very few times that I've ever seen the former fighter used as a fighter bomber, which was slightly curious given its sort of semi bomber genealogy in terms of design, but there we go. It's one of the few times they actually did that. So yeah, it's really quite innovative as they set it up.
So what actually happened then, Phil? What really went on? Because it's as you've kind of alluded to in certain aspects, and I think we can all sort of come to a realization that it probably hasn't gone particularly well, has it? It's not a success story through and through.
It seems like it's something that we don't really want to do, but the Russians want us to, so we're like, oh, all right then.
Yeah, so we're not fully into it, are we, really? Yeah.
Yeah, there is a... certainly a degree. Well, yeah, it is absolutely the case that the Russians are saying we need you to do something about this, and certainly the Royal Navy is sat there saying, yeah, this is not a terribly good idea. Although, I mean, they do go for it as best they possibly can, and as I say, it's a pretty innovative operation with one of the most powerful, well, with the most powerful carrier strike force that they can put together. So it's not a lack of willingness, I suppose, but yeah, there is a distinct lack of happiness that they're being pushed into this. And I mean, it doesn't go terribly well from the off, because as with as ends up being the case, and bear in mind we haven't run the first Arctic convoy yet. That kicks off mid-August, around the 12th of August, I think, is the first of the Arctic convoys leaves Liverpool, the Dervish convoy. So this is actually preceding the start of the Arctic convoys. And they sort of follow the similar route. So they head up from Scapa Flow. They go to Iceland first to refuel. So you know, really keep the tanks topped off. Then head north, refueling along the way, just to, again, sort of keep the tanks topped off, and head for the strike. I mean, it didn't, just to dial myself back a bit, I mean, it didn't actually start terribly well because, I mean, one of the destroyer escorts escorting the group runs into a mine as they're heading into Iceland. I mean, this is... And the ship survives, but it's not the best of omens, if you will, for the start of the operation. But they head up, and so they do their refueling bit successfully, and find themselves off Petsamo and Kirkenes, and they then sort of, you know, bright daylight start ranging up on the flight decks to launch the strike, and you know, as much force as they can possibly muster, both fighters and the strike bombers. Unfortunately, literally, you know, as they're ranging up, relatively early in the morning, they get spotted. Heinkel reconnaissance aircraft spots them. And of course, radios a warning in. Now, it's considered by, you know, Wake Walker sits there and looks at it and thinks, you know, should we call it off? Should we not do this and back off? But decides that, you know, what the hell? Maybe we'll be able to catch them unawares. They hopefully won't be able to react quickly enough, and we're, you know, the aircraft are literally just flying off into the air at that point. And he said, right, the hell with it. Let's just do it. And they go in to try and basically sink whatever German transports and supply ships are sat in these two ports. Furious is given Petsamo and the Finnish side, and Victorious with her so Furious has got the Swordfish, so slightly shorter range, and Victorious with the full Albacore air group is given given Kirkenes. And really, as it goes pretty badly. They arrive, and there's pretty much nothing in there, in either port. There's virtually no ships at all. Very little in terms of facilities that they can hit or anything like that. So they, you know, torpedo strangely a couple of piers, bomb a couple of fuel tanks, and that's really about kind of it. The key bit, really, though, is that, you know, basically they run into, and particularly the guys flying over Kirkenes, because it's Norway and the Norwegian airfields are in, you know, really serious, you know, seriously close. The Luftwaffe responds rapidly, and Kirkenes it's a mess. They lose, I think it's 11. I mean, that's almost an entire squadron. 11 of the Fairey Albacore strike bombers, and I think it's 4 of the former fighters. the strike on Petsamo by the Furious Air Group. I think they lose, what is it, one or two albacores and a fulmar. So I mean they also get intercepted by German fighters, but the resistance is far less. But Kenes is just a horror show. And as I say, they've basically sunk one ship, torpedoed a couple of couple of piers, bombed a couple of fuel tanks, and virtually lost a complete squadron of albacores. And they then sort of fly back to the carriers and land on and start to get out of there. But I mean they have another job to do, which is part of the reason for the refueling setup. And they are supposed to run another raid on Tromso on the way back, again Norwegian port, to try and sever the supply lines. So what they have to do is transfer basically a squadron. It was essentially Roy Baker Faulkner's 812 squadron, Swordfish, go over to Victorious, and Furious is just sort of sent home because the losses have just been so high, it's just ridiculous. And they reinforce Victorious's air group from Furious and send Furious home to try and run this second operation, which again I think they run a run a reconnaissance over it this time and discover that it's there's nothing really there. So they then turn for home and head home. But I mean it's been a mess. Jack Tovey is absolutely scathing about it. He sort of sits there and says, told you this was going to happen. And he says, praises the gallantry and wonderful bravery of his pilots and so forth. And he says, the losses have been severe. I trust the encouragement to the morale of our allies was proportionately great, as the losses suffered. You would call it passive aggressive, although I'm not entirely sure how passively that was written. Mm. He was not a happy bunny because obviously they've just lost one of their main strike squadrons for very, very little result. The Fulmers managed to shoot down two ME-109s, I think, in the process of this. But the loss is just horrifying, and it's something of a mess.
Mm. So beyond appeasing Russia, is there anything to take from this?
Well, it was really obviously a good sort of first experiment in what might be termed modern aircraft carrier actions, in terms of getting up there with the ATSI refueling and this sort of thing. But yeah, it's difficult to say what the carrier strike itself really achieved. I mean, apart from the obvious stuff that I've mentioned already, whether it seriously discouraged the Germans from continuing to supply Dietl's forces at sea is an open question. Possibly not. I suspect really more to the point was really what I think Tovey actually wanted to do, which is to use submarines to interdict the supply lines, which both the Royal Navy and particularly the Soviets, who actually had a very, very good and actually really quite successful submarine force, this is what they actually do, and they do this over a prolonged period. Now, say whether or not the addition or the additional knowledge of the Germans that the British could actually turn up with a carrier airstrike at any point, and potentially, had they been slightly luckier, had there been more ships in harbour or whatever, actually done some real damage to the supply lines, it's an open question and probably not one we'll ever really get to the bottom of. But the actual interdiction of the supply lines is useful, and it does help because, you know, fairly obviously Murmansk does not fall. Detel's offensive into Russian-held territory doesn't get there, so you know there is an effect. His logistics are affected by this campaign, and Murmansk survives, and the Arctic convoys keep going and keep running. So the naval campaign in and of itself was a success, at least contributed to the successful defense of the Murmansk Oblast by Soviet forces. As to whether Operation EF, which was its code name, the carrier strike contributed, as I say, difficult to say. You'd like to say yes. There is at least a good chance that it's no.
Phil, thank you so much for coming on to educate Beth and I about something we didn't even know existed. Because we really didn't.
Not at all. It's boats and it's
my pleasure world entirely. War. Yeah.
No, thank you. That was outstanding.
Thank you, Phil.
Yeah, I had no idea that we were that far up. Like, I knew the convoys, but I didn't know that there was a strike happening up there and more stuff. And I also didn't know that, like, everybody was trying to get into the Soviet Union at the same time.
Yeah, that bit's, I mean, the Finland bit is obviously awkward, because of course, you know, Finland was at the time and, you know, remains a democracy and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those odd ones that goes against the whole, oh, democracies don't fight each other.
Well, it's like when you think about the reason we went into World War One, because somebody stomped into Belgium when they had no right to. Well, it wasn't really the reason we went into World War One, but it was touted as poor little Belgium, a bigger nation trampling over a smaller one to get what it wants. And that's kind of what we're all doing here.
Yeah. But I mean, you're quite right. I mean, it's something I need to do something on somewhere down the line. Is that the naval campaign against Norway? I mean, everybody sort of knows about the Norwegian campaign in 1940, but the naval war, and obviously the Arctic convoys are a significant part of this. But the naval war up the Norwegian coast is a surprisingly regular thing. The home fleet keeps running aircraft carrier strikes, just potter up there and batter the snot out of German merchant shipping, taking iron ore out of Narvik and so forth. And they do this on a fairly regular basis. I mean, it's actually one of the few instances where the Americans join in as well. I think it's 43. The Americans send the carrier Ranger to join the home fleet, and it's one of the few times one of their big carriers actually runs a carrier strike in the Atlantic or in the European theater. Is this one where they join the home fleet and disappear off up the Norwegian coast, smashing stuff up? And it continues right the way throughout the war, and nobody really kind of knows about it. They know the Arctic convoys, they know the Norway campaign in 1940, but the rest of it is a bit of a mystery to a lot of people. And yeah, this is one of the key points of it. They were even still running. I think they ran one or two carrier strikes on the Norwegian coast. Even in the middle of the Battle of Britain, they're still doing this that nobody really knows about. and everybody forgets. So, yeah, it's an interesting campaign and one I really ought to do something more on.
You got loads of free time, right?
yeah.
Although I don't know about Beth, but I'm absolutely nicking that phrase, batter the snot out of.
You can have that one this time, Alex. I'll let you have that one.
That one. Beth's still scarred. When we come off air, I'm going to tell you why no one at History Hack is ever going to look at snot in the same way again. But Phil, thank you very, very much for coming on to augment Boaty Week with the World War II.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.